offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it's my pleasure to join you as always from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse in detail, in reference with Swami's beautiful words, Swami's Gita Vahini, and the many discourses that Swami has given. We are in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and the most important feature or portion of this chapter is the one on meditation, where Krishna speaks about how one must meditate, how one must carry oneself through this process, and very, very useful for those sadhakas who want to take up this seriously and sincerely. So that is the portion that we are going through. We went through shlokas 11, 12 and 13 last time, and these are precisely the shlokas that speak about the physical modalities of meditation. The seat, especially the 11th one which we started with, Krishna speaks about the seat on which one sits while performing meditation, the place where one sits, the place which is desha, the seat which is asana. He says, find a clean place. The seat should not be too high, should not be too low. And then he says, the seat should be made of kusha grass, on top of which there is an animal skin, like a deer skin, and on top of that, a soft white cloth. And on that, the person who meditates has to sit and perform his meditation. We discussed the idea behind all of these instructions. When we begin the sadhana of meditation, I think it is a good idea to control as much as possible some of these external factors to ensure that there are no distractions when we are meditating. Right? That is the whole idea of all of these simple instructions which are given. Something as simple as, when you sit, you should not be worried about falling off that seat. You know, that is the simple instruction which is given. Let it not be too high. Again, let it not be too low, or you don't sit on the floor itself. The factors of humidity, the factors of the chill that could come from the floor, and all of these simple things. But the idea behind it is, can you control what is around you as much as possible so that your mind is not distracted from meditating? Because it is a difficult process. It is not easy to control the mind. We are going to talk about that in the later chapters. Because it is not easy, whatever can be controlled, to begin with, you control. Eventually, the idea is none of these physical factors should matter for somebody who is lost in samadhi. But for a beginner, taking control of some of these external factors is a good way to start with. And that's why Swami says that such a process is referred to as sukha dhyana, meditation being done in comfort. But it is not that one should seek these comforts, but one should seek non-distraction, and that's the whole idea. And apart from all of this, all these instructions also had an inner significance. For instance, Swami says that the true seat for one who meditates is the body itself, and the true asana is the mind. So when Krishna says that the place has to be pure, the reference is to the mind and the body as much as it is to the place where one sits. And we discussed how to do meditation, a certain amount of purity is necessary. But at the same time, in the 12th shloka, Krishna says that one must meditate with the desire to purify oneself as the goal. So the end goal of meditation is also to attain purity. To perform meditation also, one needs a certain amount of purity. The necessary purity that we talk of is to lead a dharmic life, to lead a moral and straightforward life. And the purity that is aimed at, one wants to achieve, is the purity from raga and dvesha, which eventually will lead to the sublimation of doership and ahankara, and we've spoken about all of that in the 3rd and 4th chapter. The other obvious goal of meditation is to attain ekagrata, or one-pointedness. And that one-pointedness has to be attained from anekagrata, or multi-pointedness. And even as we were going through all of these points, I was reading out relevant passages from Swami's discourses, wherever Swami speaks of all of these points. If any of you have missed, I think, and you're interested in meditation especially, I think it would be a good idea to go back and listen to some of them, because many, many discourses Swami has spoken about it. Some of our listeners may not be aware, you know, when we are students, when we were students, you're young, there is a flash of idealism in you, especially when you're close to Swami, and there is this craving to please Swami in whatever you do, and most of us took up whatever simple sadhanas that we do in this desire to please Swami. So there was this chance for a lot of us to get wrongly, in a sense, misguided by reading books or listening from people as to how one has to do sadhana and all of that. So very regularly Swami would come and speak about some of these sadhanas, simplifying it and ensuring that we do not get too lost in the complexities or unnecessary details. So many of these discourses are there for us to read and listen, and some of them I quoted last time. Coming back to the summary of what we did last week, the 13th verse, Krishna speaks about the asana. He spoke about desha, the place, the asana, which is the seat on which one sits, and then he speaks about asana, or the posture. We also went through other discourses where Swami gives a few more tips as to how one must sit, the Padmasana, how one must sit in, hands, what position they have to be in. I'll not repeat all of that. But one important thing which Krishna himself mentions in this shloka is about sitting straight. You sit in a manner by which the back, the neck and the head are held in one line, and one tries to look at the tip of the nose. One does not concentrate or meditate on the tip of the nose, but one tries to look at that in a way of looking away from the outside world. And Swami very practically said that sometimes when you close your eyes, you're likely to fall asleep. So you keep it open, not completely open, so that what happens in front of you or things around you do not distract you. But you, that is why the idea of looking at the tip of the nose is suggested. But these are all initial practices which help us as we are trying to get into this important sadhana of meditation. So those were the three verses that we went through. The topic still continues. Krishna is going to continue to speak about meditation, but some of the things that he is going to tell now will be more related to the attitude, the internal process of meditation and such things. So we listen to the next verse, that is verse number 14. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail, because there's a lot to be discussed of what Krishna is conveying in these next two shlokas. So over now to shloka number 14, we'll listen to it in Brother Shyam's voice, one of our alumnus who has very beautifully rendered these shlokas for us, and then we'll discuss about it.
Prashantatma vigata bhihi brahmachari vrate sthitah manas samyamya machitto yukta asita matparah.
Being calm-minded, fearless, firm in the vow of celibacy, controlling the mind completely, let the master of yoga remain, fixing one's mind in me and having me alone as the supreme goal. So that is the 14th verse of the 6th chapter. Till now we spoke about the physical setting for meditation, where to sit, on what to sit, how to sit. Predominantly this was what has been discussed in the past 2-3 verses, as I just summarized before I played that shloka. In this shloka, Krishna speaks more about the internal state. Because at the end of the day, meditation is not about posture and having an incense stick or what mat you're sitting on and how beautifully your altar is decorated. It is about what happens within, what happens inside. That is why earlier Krishna had said, spirituality is a very secretive path, where you are your own friend and you are your own enemy. So what happens inside is most important when we talk about meditation. As we saw, even when Krishna spoke about cleanliness of the place, Swami had made it a point to mention that inner cleanliness is so important. So if it so happens that you don't have a kusha grass mat or a deer skin, you can still do meditation, right? Some if you listen to this discourse and this explanation and say that, oh, I don't have these, I don't have a deer skin at home, I don't have kusha grass, can I still meditate? Yes, you can still meditate, but some of the points that are being mentioned here are more important than the seat that was described. On the other hand, let us say that if you ask me, you know, there is a person who is bedridden or paralyzed, and that person cannot sit straight and cannot sit on the floor. Can he or she meditate? What do you think will be my answer? The answer will be, of course, they can meditate, right? Because at the finally, if you're talking about meditation, what is most critical for meditation is not what is outside, what is inside. The inner instruments is what we are trying to control through this process of meditation, purify through this process of meditation. So what is required is so much what is inside than what is outside. And as we saw last week, even when we talk about what is outside and maintaining the balance in what is outside, it is only with the view that the mind must not be distracted or be drawn into other thoughts, right? A few shlokas later, Krishna is going to give a few more pointers about what sort of a lifestyle one has to maintain. This is only about the period of meditation, but generally what kind of a lifestyle one has to maintain if one has to be able to meditate. I think that is going to come later. We might take it up next week maybe. But everything is only a means of maintaining the controllable factors outside, as I mentioned in the summary, to ensure that meditation is facilitated. So what must we do when we meditate? We have done all of this, we have set everything, we have sat down, but what must we meditate upon? Before we go into the shloka itself, let us once remind ourselves of the whole idea behind this process of meditation again. The karma yogi is to set aside some time every day, and Swami says it should be the same time every day, so that one can refocus the mind on the goal that he has laid his eyes upon. So when we begin on this journey, who we are during this period of meditation will be a little different from who we are otherwise, how we behave otherwise, right? So when I'm sitting for meditation, I might look like a very calm person, I might look a very serene and self-satisfied person. But the rest of the day, I might be agitated, I might be, very ambitious. Being ambitious is not wrong, but in a way, a very rajasic person, right? So it might look contradictory, it might look hypocritical, but I think it is quite natural that what you are during your meditation in the beginning will be different from what you are otherwise, and that is how it is meant to be. But the goal is, the person I am while I'm meditating should penetrate or permeate into the person I am through the other parts of the day, till a point where there is no difference between the meditating me and the non-meditating me, right? That is the whole idea. The mental state that you have during meditation or samadhi, you are supposed to have that throughout your day or throughout your waking hours, and that's the whole idea. So Krishna says in this shloka, Prashantatma, a person of serenity, a person of peace. So Krishna is referring to the meditator as a Prashantatma, suggesting that to be calm is the primary step. I can't be sitting in meditation and be agitated. Again, we are only talking about the period of meditation, those 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour that you set aside to meditate every day. So when Krishna refers to the meditator as Prashantatma, he says the primary step is, while sitting for meditation, sit with a calm mind. And that is the reason Swami also suggests that you choose the early hours of the morning. We've spoken about this when we discussed the hostel schedule in Swami's hostels, and also when one of the listeners had asked me this question about the importance of praying early in the morning during one of the Answering Booth programs. One of the reasons that Swami gives is that the early morning hours from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m., Swami says those are sattvic hours. Just like how certain activities can be categorized as sattvic, certain food items can be categorized as sattvic, certain kind of behavioral traits can be categorized as sattvic, even the day can be broken up into sattvic, rajasic and tamasic hours. And in that, Swami says, morning 4 to 8 are considered sattvic hours, and they also overlap with what we refer to as the Brahma Muhurtam. The Brahma Muhurtam actually starts around 3 o'clock, but there is a good overlap between the sattvic hours, which is 4 to 8, and the Brahma Muhurtam period. Swami says it is most conducive for such prayer sessions and sadhana. So if we are looking for a time when we can be naturally a prashantatma, the early morning hours is the best option that is available to us. The other reason why early morning meditation is a very good idea for a karmayogi or a sadhaka is something that I will repeat again, but I will come to that when I am discussing about the next shloka, or the later part of the same shloka, not the next shloka, the later part of the same shloka, I will mention that. For now, here Krishna says, prashantatma vigata bhihi. One must be peaceful and vigata bhihi, free of fear. Then he also says, brahmachari vrate sthitaha, being firm in the vow of brahmacharya. Let us first talk about this instruction of sitting without fear. When you're meditating, you should not have fear. Vigata bhihi. I can understand if Krishna instructs overcoming sleep is important, because that happens when I try to meditate. I can relate to that instruction. If he says try not to let the thoughts go astray, that is also understandable and relatable, because that happens to all of us all the time. Why vigata bhihi? Without fear. I feel this can be explained in two ways. Again, from the historical context, maybe it is a suggestion that don't sit in such a place where there may be other dangers to your life. You know, if you're sitting in the forest, the fear of wild animals probably. And as I mentioned, one of the commentators had said that don't sit on a tree and meditate. The fear of falling off might be there, or sitting in a cave. This is probably one of the ways of looking at vigata bihi. Without fear, you should meditate. But of course, this is a superficial explanation. I wouldn't dismiss it altogether, but this is one of the explanations that we can give. The other explanation I feel that makes sense to me, and I'll share it with you, is there is a difference between a prayer and a meditation. Especially prayers that we do when we are in trouble or when our mind is disturbed. Like in the present medical emergency that we are all facing, we all are participating in prayers. In fact, we just started this program after we completed the collective prayer. We all are trying to spend more time in prayer than we usually do, right? Or you're walking down a lonely road, it is very dark. You instantly and spontaneously you start praying, you start chanting Swami's name. I know a person who is extremely terrified about flying, right? And this person, the moment the flight takes off till the flight lands, constant namasmarana goes on, right? So there is a focus in that prayer. There's no doubt about that. You know, when you're in fear, when you're in anxiety, there seems to be a great focus in prayer. I'm sure many of us will agree that in the present times, we are all spending a lot of time and a lot of concentration in the prayer and the bhajan sessions that we're all participating than probably 1 month ago when it was a regular thing to go for once a week a bhajan or something like that. So when there is fear, when we are endangered in some manner, there is a certain amount of focus in that prayer. There's no doubt about that. Sometimes the mind will not think of anything else, you know, when you're in a situation like that. But such prayer is not meditation. That's why Krishna is specifically saying the mind must be calm and it must be free of fear. He's already said it, said that it must be free of aspirations and expectations also, right? In the 10th shloka, Krishna had said, Nirashihi aparigraha, without expectations and covetousness. These are the descriptions that differentiate prayer from meditation. In fact, later, towards the end of the program, I'll read out another excerpt from Swami's writings. Very beautifully, Swami explains the difference between, in fact, Swami categorizes meditation into three types. And the meditation that we're talking about is when you do not have any aspirations and vigata bhi, without any fear. This is not to say that prayer is inferior and one who meditates is superior. No, that's not the idea at all. In the spiritual journey, prayer has a certain role. Meditation has a separate role, right? There is no mixing of the two. These are all techniques and tools that we use in the spiritual journey. When in fear, chanting God's name has a certain utility, has a certain way in which it works on our mind. But we are just stating that what Krishna is describing as meditation here is meant for a different purpose in the spiritual path, and it is different from prayer that is uttered in a certain anxiety, with a certain fear or with a certain expectation. Going on, Krishna then specifically mentions Brahmachari Vrate Sthitaha, being firm in the vow of Brahmacharya. I think we all know what is the vow of Brahmacharya. The first thought that always occurs to us when we say Brahmacharya is celibacy and continence, which is not wrong. Definitely Brahmacharya has a very strong relation to continence. So is Krishna saying that to practice meditation, one must necessarily be celibate, one must necessarily be a bachelor? Only brahmacharis can practice meditation. Is that what Krishna is hinting here? Personally, I highly doubt so. Brahmacharya also refers to one of the ashramas in life, right? We say brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha and sannyasa. So brahmacharya is also one of the ashramas of life. If we want to really understand what Krishna means here when he says brahmachari vrate sthitaha, with the vow of brahmacharya, you must sit down and meditate. We can probably look at this ashrama of brahmacharya and see what is there that we can learn from that period that we all have come through, right? And see whether there are any pointers we can pick from there. If you really look at this period when we were students, it is actually a period of immense privilege in our life, except for those people who had a very, very tough childhood growing up, when they could not freely go to school or they had to support their family in some manner. And there are always some examples of that who had a very, very difficult childhood growing up. But for most of us, I think the student period in our life, what we refer to as Brahmacharya, or the childhood and the young adult period before we get into the grihastha phase, is a period of immense privilege. Though we crib and cry about it so much, when we are students and teenagers, we don't have freedom, we can't do this, I can't come at whatever time I want, I can't eat what I want. However much we crib and complain, it is a period where we lead the most carefree life in our entire lifetime. That's the period when we are not necessarily directly responsible for anyone other than ourselves, right? Most of the time we are only responsible for ourselves. We don't have the need to take care of somebody. We don't have the need to feed somebody, earn for somebody, work for somebody. I'm saying again, it's just a average. There are some people who had to start working very early in life. I'm not talking about such a period. But generally, if someone has led this, who's following this Brahmacharya, Grihastha and so on and so forth, you can say that this period when they are students, when they're going to school, when they're going to college, your parents are feeding you, your parents are clothing you, everything, all your needs are taken care of. It's a period of privilege. And ideally speaking, that is the time when without any constraints, we have the opportunity to pursue knowledge and learning. That is why Swami would define Brahmacharya for us a little differently. It's not merely being a bachelor. In fact, I'll just read out a few lines from a discourse that Swami gave on 23rd of April, 1988. And Swami says, and I quote, Swami says, in fact, the entire discourse is labeled as Brahmacharya itself. Swami says, Brahmacharya means leading a life of pure thoughts, pure actions, and pure aspirations. Unfortunately today, people tend to regard Brahmacharya as living somehow in an unmarried state. The term Brahmacharya carries within it its sacred import. Brahmacharya means whatever thoughts we entertain, whatever actions we perform, whatever enterprises we undertake, they should all be filled with the consciousness of Brahman, the supreme omnipresent divine. Conducting ourselves with the awareness that the divine is present everywhere is true Brahmacharya. End of quote. So clearly Swami says, one point that Swami makes it categorically clear is, just because you're not married, just because you're a student and you're not earning your own livelihood, it doesn't make you a brahmachari. So true brahmacharya is to be in pure thoughts, to be occupied with thoughts of God. Now the kind of life that we all are living, right? We have our commitments to work, we have commitments at home, we have our own preoccupations with life in general, our entertainment and our social media and everything. To be able to be a brahmacharya the way Swami has described is actually a luxury, especially when you have to feed a family, especially when you have to earn and work, right? Swami would say that the moment you go into your office, a certain amount of your freedom is gone because the kartavyam that you have, which is the duty that you have, puts a certain curbing on your freedom. Similarly, when you go to your house, there is a certain way you have to speak with members of your family, so you lose a certain bit of your freedom, right? So the moment you are supposed to feed somebody, the moment you're supposed to, you are responsible for somebody, that takes away a little bit of freedom from you to be able to practice some of these things that Swami speaks about. That is why the student phase that we all have lived through is a period of luxury and a period in which we could have freely practiced idealism. Whether we did it or not, I think that each one of us are the ones who can vouch for that. But it is a period. If we had chosen to pursue idealism, if we had chosen to pursue true learning, the way Swami says, Brahma Vidya, no period other than that is suitable for, without any worry, without any thoughts, that you can practice that. And even in the past, when you talk about a brahmachari, a brahmachari is supposed to be somebody who lives in the gurukula where he doesn't have to worry about food, he's fed, and even if there's an extension of the brahmachari period, he's supposed to receive alms from the society. Again, it is the society that is supporting his learning in that manner. So when Krishna speaks about brahmacharya during meditation, I feel it is this state of mind where you can, without any desire, without any thoughts of commitments, the complex relationships and responsibilities, without all of these pulling and dragging your thoughts, you can give yourself up to thoughts of Brahman. It is very easy to have such ideals at that age when there are not too many challenges, right? If you're not worried about completing a project tomorrow, and of course, schools and colleges also have their own things, but I'm telling about that's a different kind of a responsibility. Those of us who have been students and now who are householders, we know the difference between the two. I think most of you agree with me in saying that when we look back in our student phase, we can relate to how easily we could pursue idealism, right? And that's why that phase of brahmacharya is supposed to be, don't think about how you will implement some of these learnings that you are being taught. When you're being told that you should always be dharmic, you should always follow dharma, you should always speak the truth. All of these get challenged when you get into the phase of a grihastha. But in the brahmacharya phase, don't worry about all of that. Just take in all of this idealism, right? So it is very easy to follow these idealisms when we are in that brahmachari phase. So when Krishna says, with the vow of brahmacharya, meditate, the point that is being conveyed, at least what I understand, is that Krishna is saying, for those few moments of the day, those few minutes that you sit down for meditation, can you go back to that brahmachari phase where you're able to focus on Brahman, focus on the truth, focus on these lessons that we're all speaking about, and be lost in that without thinking, you know, everything is divine and I am the Atman, the body doesn't need to be nourished, I'm not this body. Oh my God, but what will I do about my food the next day? Don't give yourself any of those thoughts. Imagine yourself to be a brahmachari who is supported by the society, who is taken care of by Lord through these many people. That is the kind of a free mental state which Krishna is suggesting, with which one should sit down. Eventually, one should become a nitya brahmachari. Right? One may have 100 responsibilities and commitments around, but the mind is ever steady and constant in Brahman. One becomes the sthita prajna. That is the state of a nitya brahmachari. But before that, as we've been saying, that idea is practiced in these few minutes a day when we sit down for meditation. Having said that, continence or celibacy also has a very good and important role in the spiritual journey. So when Krishna speaks about following the brahmachari vratam, brahmachari vrate sthitaha, we must consider that also. But that must be considered as a kind of a lifestyle that one has to follow. I think a couple of months back, I had played a talk on this very segment on brahmacharya, right, where I had spoken about extensively about what Swami says about this brahmachari lifestyle. And Swami makes it very clear that there is a certain brahmacharya that one can follow even in the householder's stage. Right? It is a disciplined lifestyle based on certain mental attitudes that we must develop. I'll not repeat all of those here again, then we'll never finish the shloka. In case any of you are interested, you can go back and look for that talk. I think I'd named it Brahmacharya, the Royal Path. In case you're finding trouble locating it, do send me a mail. I'll send you the link. I'd collected all what Swami has said about Brahmacharya in that particular talk. Coming back to the shloka, then Krishna says, Manaha samyamya, controlling the mind. Till now Krishna was using the phrase Atma samyama, which means controlling oneself, controlling the body and the mind. Since here in this shloka the reference is only to the internal state, I think Krishna specifically mentions Manaha samyamya, control the mind. What he says next is quite important and interesting. He says, Machitto yukta asit matparaha. Yukta, the yogi or the aspirant, here the one who is trying to meditate, asit, should sit, more generally, should be steadily focused. And then Krishna says, Machitto matparaha. As we generally say on the show, Krishna now speaks or has shifted to the Ishvara mode, where he now starts speaking as the Supreme Lord himself. He says, Machitto matparaha. The sadhaka must focus on me and as me as the supreme goal. I think the instructions here are very, very clear. People do meditation for many, many purposes, and it serves many purposes too. If you meditate regularly, you will find that if you're a student, you get better at your studies. If you're a surgeon, you will find that you're becoming, if you meditate, you are very calm. You're able to focus more on the job that you're doing. If you're a stockbroker, if you're a businessman, you will find that meditation helps you calm your mind and take better decisions. So meditation serves many purposes, but meditation must be done with only one goal, and that is the ultimate goal. And Krishna is saying, as me as the goal, you must meditate as me as the goal, not so that I become a better musician, I become a better businessman, I become a better CA, doctor, or whatever is your profession. Meditation should have as its purpose me, Krishna says. Attaining me should be the only goal of your meditation. I'd mentioned that there was another point about early morning meditation that I will repeat in the later part of the shloka. Swami had said this to students once. Now, Swami had said, the sadhana that you do during the day, be it seva, japam, bhajans, or whatever is it that you do during the day, it is like depositing money in a current account. Right? Swami said, even as you keep doing all the sadhana, it is like money adding up in that current account. As and when you need grace, Swami said that he will use whatever has been accumulated in that current account to come and protect you, come and save you, come and give you the necessary assistance. But then Swami said, but the grace that is earned by early morning prayers, what we refer to as doing in Brahma Murta or in that sattvic period from 4 to 8, Swami said, whatever sadhana is done in that period, the grace that is accumulated through that, Swami said, it is like putting money in FD. You can't keep withdrawing from that. Swami said, that money or that grace, I will not use it for the problems that you face during the day. Swami said that early morning prayers, the grace that is earned through that will be used only for one's spiritual benefit, only for long-term spiritual benefit. So when we choose the early morning time for meditation, it takes care of many of the points that Krishna is making when he's talking about meditation. It can ensure that we are alone. Of course, given that others at home don't wake up so early, otherwise there'll again be a crowd in the puja room. But predominantly by waking up a little early in the early in the morning, we can ensure that we can be a little alone compared to the other periods of the day. And it's an hour when the mind is naturally calm. And when meditation is done for the supreme purpose of reaching God, mat paraha, it makes much sense to choose that early morning time. As Swami said, whatever is done during that time is used only for this final goal. Before we go to the next shloka, just a word about mat chitto. What Krishna says, focus on me. Attaining me should be the goal, and I should be the dhyeya. I should be the one you meditate upon too. Krishna clearly states, think of me and have reaching me as your goal. There are a lot of techniques where people meditate upon objects. People meditate upon some mantras. Some mantras are just like some syllables, right? When we were in school, we were taught certain kind of meditation where the teacher would just give you a syllable and say that meditate upon this. I think Krishna is making it very clear that meditating on God, on Brahman, is the best form of meditation. He says, meditate upon me. And this can also be interpreted as meditate upon one's own divine nature. Because when Krishna says me and you, the essence is the same. We are divine as the Lord, as divine as Swami, as divine as Krishna, right? So when I sit and contemplate on God as the Supreme, be it Krishna, Rama or Swami, I am contemplating not on the form necessarily, but on the divine nature. And that nature is our true nature as well. So we can say meditating on God or on the divine principle that permeates this whole creation is the best meditation that one can do, and that is what is being suggested by Krishna here. We'll go to the next shloka, which is also a general one on about how meditation has to be done. Few points that I wanted to mention as part of this shloka. I will push it to after this, listening to the next shloka. So we'll listen to the next shloka, the 15th shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning. We'll discuss about that and probably we'll conclude with that for this week.
युञ्जन्नेवं सदात्मानम् योगी नियतमानसः शान्तिं निर्वाणपरमाम् मत्संस्थामधिगच्छति.
Thus, always keeping the mind balanced, the yogi with the mind controlled attains to the peace abiding in me, which culminates in liberation. So that's the 15th shloka. As I had mentioned, what one is supposed to experience and is trying to practice in this period of meditation must eventually become the norm, right? It must become one's nature, and that is the purpose of meditation itself. But before we get to that, I would like to emphasize a little more on a point that Krishna made in the previous shloka and then continue from there. Why is it important? A couple of things that he said: to meditate without fear and to meditate on the Lord and to meditate as the Lord as the final goal. In Swami's Dhyanavahini, Swami speaks about three types of dhyana, three types of meditation, and what Krishna speaks of here as the most ideal way of meditation for a karma yogi, for a sadhaka, for you and me, which is the best type, is what Swami speaks of first. I will read out that entire excerpt from the second chapter. It's a fairly large passage, but it is self-explanatory. And Swami so very beautifully has related that point, so I thought it's best to read it out. It's also a way by which we can listen to Swami's words directly. So Swami says, again the reference, second chapter of Dhyanavahini, the three types of meditation, and I quote, "There are three ways by which aspirants try to enter the path of meditation. The path of truth, Sattvika Marga, the path of passion and emotion, Rajasika Marga, and the path of ignorance, Tamasika Marga. First, the pure, serene Sattvic path. On this path, one considers repetition of the name and meditation as a duty and suffers any amount of trouble for its sake. One is fully convinced that all this is just an illusion, so one does only good under all conditions and at all times. One desires only the good of all and is always loving towards all. One spends time uninterruptedly in the remembrance and meditation of the Lord. One does not crave even the fruit of repeating the name and meditation. One leaves it all to the Lord. The second, the passionate, restless Rajasic Marga. Here, one craves the fruit of one's act at every step. If the fruit is not available, then gradually laxity and disgust overpowers the spiritual aspirant and the repetition of the name and meditation slowly dry up. The third, the ignorant or tamasic path. This path is even worse. The Lord will come into the memory only in times of danger or acute suffering, or when one is the victim of loss or pain. At such times, such a person prays and vows to arrange this worship or puja, offer this particular food or build this kind of a temple to the Lord. One will be calculating the quantity of food placed before the Lord, the tribute offered at his feet, the number of prostrations performed, and the number of times the shrine was circled. And after having done all this, one asks for the proportionate reward. For those who adopt this attitude in meditation, the mind and intellect can never be pure. Most people now follow only the passionate, restless, rajasic and dull, ignorant, tamasic path in repeating the divine name and meditation. However, the very intention of repeating the divine name and meditation is to purify the mind and the intellect. In order to achieve this, the first path is best, the sattvic meditation. When the mind and the intellect become pure, they will shine with the splendor of the understanding of the Atma. End of quote. So very beautifully Swami explains about the three types of dhyana. And what we are speaking here is the sattvic marga, where the only goal, if at all anything, or the purpose behind the meditation is to purify the mind. The mind is being focused on the Lord, not with any benefit that one can get, but only out of love of the Lord, right? And then Swami says about the rajasic marga, where one is very sincerely following the path, but constantly thinking, am I benefiting? Am I benefiting? Is it helping me? And when you're not able to see the benefit, the enthusiasm slowly dries up. And Swami says the worst is, you think of God only when you have a need, right? I don't know whether Swami will consider us as not being a part of this, because most of us are like that. Only when we are in trouble, we tend to turn to Swami, right? Turn to God, turn to worship. So Swami says that is the most undesirable path. So what has to be meditated upon? What should we meditate upon? We must meditate upon the Lord. And with what attitude? That this is part of my duty, right? That is the most important point that Swami said about sattvic marga. You know, when I consider myself a father or a mother, I acknowledge certain duties that relate to that role. If I consider myself or call myself a doctor or a teacher, I acknowledge certain duties related to that profession. Similarly, when I consider myself a sadhaka, sadhana becomes my duty, isn't it? That's what Swami clearly says, that one looks at meditation, repetition of the Lord's name as a commitment. I have to do this, and it doesn't matter whether there are any rewards coming. I mean, there is a sense of commitment to that sadhana that one takes up, right? And in this particular shloka that we went through, the 15th shloka, Krishna says, evam, in this manner that we have described so far, sada, always, yunjan atmanam, who having one's mind in communion, in balance, yogi niyata manasaha, the yogi who has subdued the mind, shantim, peace, nirvana paramam, the supreme nirvana, manasamstham, abiding in me, matsamstham, abiding in me, adhigachati, attains. Which means, when one meditates in this manner which has been described in all of these shlokas, the mind is focused on the Lord, eventually peace is attained, and nirvana, the supreme freedom, is attained, and all this by abiding in the Lord in thoughts, and eventually abiding in the Lord in person, in being. Eventually all of this is attained through this process of meditation. A couple of words quickly to be discussed here. Krishna says sada means always, but it does not mean that one must always be in meditation, right? That is the misconception that we spoke about last week also. But when one does this regularly, right, every day on a certain appointed time, when one does it regularly, one reaches the peace that is the very nature of nirvana, right? Matsansthaam, abiding in me, Krishna says. So eventually, the one who meditates on the Lord abides in the Lord. In one of the discourses, Swami very clearly says that when it is said that meditate on God or meditate on Swami, the idea is not to merely meditate on a form, right? Swami says, Rama, Krishna, Baba, these are at the end of the day only forms like yours. The idea is not to meditate merely on the form. It is to meditate on the divinity, right? That is one of the reasons that Swami speaks so highly of Jyoti meditation, because the flame has a quality of being undiminished in nature. And when you meditate on divinity, it is to contemplate on the idea that the same Lord is within and without. So the whole process is to remove this distinction between inside and outside. That's the whole idea of the spiritual journey itself. To remove the sense of doership and attachment, one has to remove this idea that I am different from the rest of creation, the rest of the world and the God. Speaking about jyoti meditation, Swami would say that after imagining the jyoti to be in every limb and instrument of the body, most of you will be aware of that. Swami says that eventually you have to sense that the jyoti is in every individual that you interact with. Swami says, start with those that you love and those who are dear to you, right? Because it is easy to visualize Swami in them. It's easy to visualize Swami in your parents. It is easy to visualize Swami in those people who have provided for you, who have guided you in life. So start with them. Then he says, slowly imagine that the same divine light is in those that trouble you, those you are not particularly fond of. Then start visualizing that jyoti in everyone, even those whom you might not know personally. Right? So Swami says that this expansion step in jyoti meditation is very important. Like, it's the most critical step. You should not stop with thinking that Swami is within me or Swami is in my heart. To be honest, between you and me, this is easy to do while you're meditating. Right? To think of Swami, to think that Swami is in that neighbor who's troubling me, or that senior at work who's being nasty to me, or this colleague who's being very crooked in his interaction with me. Even to think of it in meditation, it needs a little bit of calmness of mind, right? But still, it is easier to think of it during meditation than when we are physically interacting with that person who's being unpleasant to us. But the whole idea is to practice it through meditation, and let this attitude and understanding percolate into everyday activity even as we are going through that. Maybe I'll conclude today's session with a very beautiful episode that was once narrated by one of Swami's devotees. It's a very beautiful episode. This particular devotee, after he came to Swami, he wanted to somehow settle in Parthi, and he wanted to take up a job which Swami would offer him, and he said, whatever Swami asks me to do, I'll take it up, but please don't send me away, Swami. I want to be here. I want to be with you, spend the rest of my days with you. He was a young gentleman, but of course Swami had other plans for him, but Swami did not tell him no straight away. Swami told him, no, you go back, you're well educated, I will create a good position for you, and then I will call you and all of that. So in that interview, when Swami was saying this, this devotee looked at Swami and said, Swami, but I cannot live without you anymore. Don't send me back. It is becoming impossible for me to live without you there, back wherever he came from. And Swami looked at him and said, why do you think that I am not without you? Why do you think that you are without me? Then Swami did something very sweet. Swami bent down, gently touched his head and said, I am in your head. Touching his eyes, Swami said, I am in your eyes. Touching his ears, Swami said, I am in your ears. Similarly, he went on, I am in your nose. I am in your mouth. Swami touched his lip. Swami placed his hand on his chest, and Swami said, I am in your heart. I am in your feet. Swami touched his legs and said, literally Swami was doing a guided jyoti meditation for this gentleman who was sitting in front of Swami. And then Swami said, I am there everywhere. I am all around you. And Swami told him, by contemplating on this truth that I am everywhere, I am in every aspect or every limb of your body and in everyone around in the same manner, by contemplating on this truth this way, Swami said, you can experience me being with you all the time. So this session got over, this was in the interview. The next day, the same devotee was sitting for darshan and waiting for Swami to come. So he thought, okay, be waiting here, why not meditate upon what Swami told me the previous day? So he closed his eyes, he started thinking that Swami is everywhere, Swami is all around, Swami is omniscient, omnipresent all the time. In the process, this person went into such a deep meditation that he completely lost track of what was happening around. The darshan music started, Swami came out, Swami started giving darshan, he was moving around amongst the devotees in the ladies' side, then came to the gents' side, but this person had no clue because he was so lost in that deep contemplation of his. Finally, Swami came close to where he was sitting, and Swami very gently placed his hand on this person's head. And that's when this person woke up. That Swami is right in front of him, and he said, beautiful, thrilling experience when you're meditating on Swami and you're disturbed, quote unquote, and you open your eyes and you find Swami himself standing in front of you. So placing his hand on his head, Swami started speaking to the people around, and eventually Swami turned to this gentleman and Swami asked him, what are you doing? Kya karta hai? Swami said. And he looked at Swami and said, Swami, I was meditating. Oh, you were meditating. What were you meditating on? Swami asked. He said, Swami, I'm meditating that Swami is everywhere. Then Swami said, oh, am I everywhere? Swami asked him the question, am I everywhere? And he said, yes, Swami, you're everywhere. And Swami again pointed to himself and said, me? I'm everywhere? And this person said, yes, Swami, you're everywhere. Then Swami asked him, if I am everywhere, why are you closing your eyes then? And this person had no answer to give for that. So he just kept a blank face. And then Swami told him, beautiful words, close your eyes and think that Swami is everywhere. Then open your eyes and see and experience that Swami is everywhere. That is meditation. We can speak for hours on meditation, right? I can read any number of books. I can give you a little longer discourse on meditation. But can we give a better definition of meditation than this? Close your eyes and think that Swami is everywhere. Contemplate on the truth that Swami is everywhere. Then open your eyes and see and experience and live the truth that Swami is everywhere. Just like everyone who asks that question, even I too am trying hard and how to see Swami in everyone, how to experience Swami in everyone. And I should say, I'm also trying and I'm also failing as much. But if you think of it, whether we see it or not, Swami is everywhere, right? Whether I'm able to see Swami in you or not, when you come in front of me, the fact is Swami is in you. The person I don't like, the person I'm finding it difficult to interact with, whether I'm able to see Swami in that person or not, the truth is Swami is there in that person. That is the truth and it cannot be denied. But that truth at the present is hidden behind this maya of rupa and nama, form and name. And to look beyond that name and form is what is referred to as tattva darshanam, seeing the essential truth or tattva. That precisely is the goal of every spiritual endeavor, isn't it? So we can see, Swami clearly states that, close your eyes and contemplate on this truth. I don't see the truth right now, but I'm contemplating on this truth that Swami alone is there everywhere. When we listen to discourses, when we listen to satsangs, when we listen to parayanam about sacred texts like the Gita, the truth is being ingested in the form of shravanam or reading, right? The meditation that we're talking about in this chapter is about contemplating on that truth constantly. It is easier to do that when your eyes are shut, when you're sitting early in the morning, when your mind is calm, when you're not disturbed by anything. It is easier to visualize this truth that God is everywhere. And slowly, we try to live in that thought that Swami is everywhere in everyone. The whole idea is that one day we will reach a point where the meditating me and the me that goes through the rest of the day, there is no difference between the two, right? That's all is meditation, as Swami said. That's all meditation is about. So with that, dear listeners, I'll conclude this week's episode. Thank you for joining me. Do join me again next week, 7:45 p.m. now, because of the collective prayer. But I think next week would be 7:30 p.m. because the collective prayers most probably will end with the Sunday. So I'll join you all again next week. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sainam.